For today's Clue and Internet seminar on site characterization for munitions constituents, which has been sponsored by the EPA Federal Facilities Forum and the Army Corps of Engineers. My name is Jean Valance, coming from the EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, where I'll be helping to moderate today's session along with my co-host, Richard Mayer, from the EPA Federal Facilities Forum. He's one of their co-chairs out in Region 6. I'm going to cover a couple of basic housekeeping items and instructions before we start the technical presentation. And I'll give people just a minute or so as well to join if they're a little bit late before we start the technical content. Again, when you signed up for today's Clue In seminar, you would have been directed to the seminar homepage, which had a complete description of today's event. It also had a link to a 2012 paper that was produced by the EPA's Federal Facilities Forum with the support of the Army Corps of Engineers, entitled Site Characterization for Munitions Constituents, which is available to download. On that seminar homepage, there were also complete contact information listed for our presenters as well as myself, so you can find a bio for me. But more importantly, on that seminar homepage, you'll find links at the top of the page to allow you to either go to the seminar or download a copy of the presentation material. If you haven't done so already, please take a moment to either click the button and go to seminar or download the PowerPoint or PDF copy of the material. You want to be sure to have that open in front of you today and be able to navigate through the material. So I'm going to ask everyone, if you're just joining us, to remain muted on the telephone line. Do you need to hit your own mute button or hit *6 to mute your line? So for those of you who have the materials open in front of you today, please go ahead and move along to slide number 2. And if you haven't guessed it, this is our housekeeping slide. And each individual participant in Clue In seminars will be expected to manually advance through the materials. So again, if you have them printed, simply turn the page to slide 2. If you're looking at the slides in a web browser window, you can use the numbered links that appear to the left side of the screen, which will allow you to navigate to slide number 2. If you are on the telephone line, please remain muted. You can use your own mute button or hit *6 to mute your line. We will take a break for Q&A, and at that time, you are welcome to go off of mute, but until then, please remain muted. Remember, it's *6 to mute. Do not put the call on hold. There can be background music or commercials that can be disruptive. Simply remain muted until we take that break for Q&A. For those of you that are streaming the audio online, you'll be able to type up your questions electronically, and in fact, that's the preferred approach for anybody who's looking at the slides in a web browser window. If you're looking at the slides, you see a series of orange icons or buttons along the top of the slide. The arrows pointing to the left and right will help you move forward. The question mark icon, as long as a pop-up blocker has been disabled, will allow a new window to open up so you can actually type up your comment or question. So again, at any point in time, you can submit your comments and questions electronically. We would encourage you to do that early. So when we take that break for Q&A, we'll have the questions queued up, and at that time, I'll read them out loud on your behalf to be answered. You can also use that very same icon to report any technical problems you may have. Just be sure to include a telephone number where you can be reached. I want to remind everybody that today's seminar is being recorded, and within 1 week, you will automatically receive an email from me as soon as that archive is available for free replay and download. You'll also be able to forward it on to any colleagues that you think will find it helpful. If you want to, you can visit the URL you see at the bottom of slide number 2 and take a look at our almost 500 previously recorded archive seminars available for free on Clue-In. Again, our presenters today will be announcing as they move through the materials. I'm currently on slide number 2, the housekeeping slide. We will take a break for Q&A with our presenters, and at that time, I'll remind you how to unmute. But for the individual who just joined me on the phone line, please mute your phone. Remember, it's *6 to mute your line. And I thank you all in advance for your cooperation with the muting. I think those are all the basic housekeeping items I need to cover, and I think we're ready to actually begin today's presentation. So again, on slide number 2, I'm going to ask everybody to move along to slide number 3, and at this point, I'm going to turn things over to my co-moderator, Richard Mayer, the EPA's Federal Facility Forum co-chair out in EPA Region 6. Rich?
Hello, everybody. I am Rich Mayer, co-chair of the EPA Federal Facilities Forum, and as co-moderator, I would like to welcome everybody to the webinar training today titled Site Characterization for Munitions Constituents. The issue paper which this webinar is based on can be found at the web address identified on this slide. Next slide, please. This training is based on the EPA Federal Facilities Forum issue paper titled Site Characterization for Munitions Constituents. The United States Army Corps of Engineers trainers are providing technical expertise for munitions constituent sampling and analysis and are not presenting or discussing Department of Defense sampling policy. Next slide, please. Today's presenters, starting from the top left of this slide, is Harry Craig. Harry is a senior remedial project manager with the United States Environmental Protection Agency Region 10 Federal Facilities Superfund Program. Harry has 22 years of experience in technical and regulatory oversight of the cleanup of military munitions disposal sites in the Pacific Northwest and Alaska.
Harry, not supposed to use that.
Hey, Rich, before you go on, I'm very sorry to do this, but we have some individuals who have turned off to mute, so I'm going to go ahead and globally mute all the phone lines. I apologize for the inconvenience, but if people can't mute their lines, we can't give the presentation today. For all of my presenters, when you hear the command that the lines have been muted, go ahead and follow the instructions to unmute your line. So in one moment, everybody will hear an indicator that I've globally muted, and only the presenters should unmute at that time.
The leader has muted your line. To unmute your line, press pound 6.
Rich, if you could go ahead and hit pound 6 to unmute, feel free to continue on.
Thank you, Jean. At the bottom left of this slide is Jay Clausen. Jay is a physical research scientist with the United States Corps of Engineers at the Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory in Hanover, New Hampshire. Since 2005, Jay has conducted research on the application of incremental sampling methodology. At the bottom right of this slide is Marianne Walsh. Marianne has 27 years of experience in the development of analytical methods and sampling protocols for explosives, propellants, and white phosphorus. Marianne is currently serving on the NATO subcommittee entitled Munitions-Related Contamination, Source Characterization, Fate, and Transport. And now to kick off the training will be Harry Craig with EPA. Next slide, please.
Harry, remember you'll need to hit pound 6 to unmute and begin the presentation.
Hello, this is Harry Craig. Can everybody hear me?
We can, thank you.
Okay, just a little bit of background. We're on slide 6 here. A little bit of background for those who aren't familiar with use of munitions, items, and what's contained in them. The term munitions constituents refers to the chemicals present in munitions that are used. These typically include propellants and explosives that are generically known as energetic materials. The slide you see on slide 6 shows some of the application of training. Much of the data which you'll see today presented on different studies are based on active range investigations, and the reason for that is the known activities of those provides a better correlation to the type of activities that may produce residual contamination. Up in the upper left-hand corner, you see what would be a typical target for artillery or mortar rounds. The upper center photo shows how artillery rounds are employed, and the upper right-hand shows how mortars are employed. The two major chemical components that are present in munitions are explosives that are in the warheads or the projectile section of the ordnance item, and then propellants, which are in the mortar increment section or in the casing of artillery rounds. These have different functions in those. The purpose of propellants is to propel the mortar or artillery round downrange, and it consumes most but not all of the material when it's fired. The two examples here are one of the more common Army ones here for mortars and artillery. In addition to that, oftentimes off-specification or unserviceable munitions are destroyed via open burn, open detonation practices. And the center bottom one shows an example of that. Either single rounds or multiple rounds are placed on the ground or in pits or in tamped pits with earth over top of it to destroy those items with additional donor charge. So those are the three types of practices that typically occur that may result in residual contamination. The bottom left-hand corner slide shows what a detonation looks like downrange, and you can see that you get some discoloration on the snow. These particular tests were conducted to look at residual contamination, and the coloration you see there is typically of soot from TNT. In addition, you can get a very wide range of environmental conditions where training occurs or historic ranges that have been used. The one in the upper left-hand corner shows typical of desert-type environment, and the one in the lower right-hand corner shows salt marsh areas where training has occurred. So let's go ahead and move to slide number 7. In projectiles or warheads, the primary materials are referred to as secondary explosives, and those are present in the largest quantities. Two of the common ones that are used in projectiles or warheads are TNT and RDX. TNT has been used for about 100 years in munitions. RDX has been used for about 70 years. And HMX has been used for about 60 years. RDX, as it's manufactured in the United States, has HMX in it as an impurity, manufacturing impurity. So when RDX is used, there's about 10% HMX in that as well. TNT also has manufacturing impurities and environmental transformation products. And so that's one of the reasons why it's important to be able to analyze for the full range of compounds, which Marianne will talk about a little bit later. But these are one of the more these three compounds are some of the most highly used ones in munitions for about the past 50 to 100 years. Let's go to slide number 8. I mentioned also that residues on training ranges from open burn, open detonation activities. C4 explosives, which is 91% RDX plus some additional plasticizer material, has traditionally been used and is currently used for destruction as a donor charge for additional materials to destroy intact rounds or multiple rounds. Oftentimes you can get low order detonation effects where it expels chunks of the pure explosive material from the detonation. This is just an example on slide number 8 where chunks of the C4 explosive is expelled out of the demolition pits. The white crystalline material chunks or nuggets, as they're referred to, are intact pieces of the filler material that are used for donor charges. Let's go ahead and move. And also on C4 is the current version that's used as donor explosive. There were previous versions, C1, C2, and C3, that also contained a large percentage of RDX. RDX has been manufactured in the United States since 1943, so it's been used since the World War II timeframe onward. Let's go ahead and move to slide number 9. In addition to the explosives used in projectiles or warheads, propellants are used either on the mortars or in artillery rounds to project the item downrange. Two of the primary chemical components of concern from an environmental standpoint in propellants are dinitrotoluene and nitroglycerin. The base on most gun propellants is nitrocellulose, which is fairly inert but energetic material. Into that, dinitrotoluene, nitroglycerin, and occasionally nitroguanidine are placed in there for energetic properties of the propellant itself. When those items are fired downrange, as the example shown here with the 105-millimeter howitzer, it consumes a large portion of that, but there are also fibers remaining from firing in those. DNT is typically used as a ballistic modifier in propellants at a level of about 10%. So that's where DNT typically occurs. The example on the right is an anti-tank rocket. These are a direct fire weapon that are used to fire at tanks. They also have typical propellants in them that is referred to as double base propellant that contains nitrocellulose and nitroglycerin, as well as plasticizers and stabilizers. The largest amount of residue on these is actually behind the firing point with the way the weapon's designed, so it's a function of the particular weapon system that's used where the residual contamination may occur. And let's go ahead and move to slide number 10. And now Jay Clausen will start with some of the terminology on sampling.
Thank you, Harry. So we're going to go over a little bit of terminology here before we get into the case studies. and I'll talk a little bit about sampling methodologies as well. And then Marianne will follow that with analytical processing steps or procedures so that we're all kind of on the same page. And then after that, we'll get into the case studies. So in terms of terminology, some words that you're going to be seeing include incremental sampling methodology, or ISM. It's a structured composite sampling and processing protocol. The aim is to reduce data variability and provide an unbiased estimate of the mean concentration in a volume of soil targeted for sampling. Another term that you're going to see is decision unit. That's the smallest volume of soil or other media for which a decision will be made based upon ISM sampling. A DU may consist of one or more sampling units. And a DU is a little bit different than the way we've been thinking or doing environmental work in the past. In the past, we've collected individual discrete or grab samples and then either trying to extrapolate or interpolate the data to an area. The DU sample is actually a sample of the area that you're interested in. So when you get a result, you know that the result is representative of whatever area you've designated. The sampling unit, or SU, is a user-defined volume of soil or other media from which increments are collected to determine an estimate of the mean concentration. So in essence, an SU unit could be a subset or a smaller area that's sampled within a DU. You wouldn't be particularly making a decision about those data, but maybe there's an area that you're interested in that's in a larger area. So in that situation, you might use the SU. An increment is a portion of the sampling unit that is collected within a single operation of a sampling device and then combined with other increments to form an incremental sample. So if you're familiar with composite sampling, this is similar to that. Although, again, the incremental sampling methodology is more than just field sampling. It's also the processing of a sample in the laboratory. So it's a whole methodology. There's a nice document out there on the web that ITRC has put out. There's a web link here at the bottom of the slide. It goes through the ISM methodology and in great detail. So let's move on to the next slide, slide 11, and talk a little bit about different types of decision units. So here we have a decision unit for an impact area. Design of the DU or the SU, if needed, basically is a function of the specific project objectives, field conditions, degree of heterogeneity, the contaminant, and so forth. So when designating a DU or designing a DU, which is typically done during the project planning stage, you need to keep the end game in mind. So is the data going to be used for characterization, risk assessment, or remediation? If you don't take into consideration the DU design during the project planning stage, at the end result, you may not have usable data. So if we look at the upper right, this is a typical impact area. And within the impact area, we have a referred to sometimes as a central impact area. And then outside of the impact area, marked with X's, is the firing points. And then the lines extending from the firing points into the impact area is the firing fan. The little purple boxes are our decision units. In this case, in this example, we've outlined a number of decision units around some targets within the central impact area. We've also have some decision units within the impact area within the range fan because we want to acquire some information about that. And then also there's some decision units in between the firing fans. So in this particular example, your DU objective might be to determine the concentration of energetics above a defined threshold in a specific defined area. If we go and look at the bottom portion of the slide, again, we see a decision unit that's centered around a target. In this case, the area that we're sampling is 50 by 50 meters. But let's say within that decision unit, there's a couple items of interest. There might be some low-order debris or some visible chunks. So in that situation, you might designate some additional sampling units around those areas of interest. In this particular example, they're 10 by 10 meters. And the SU objective would be to assess the concentration of residue around specific items of interest. In terms of DU size, The largest that we've gone up to and done studies on is about one heck acre in size. Decision unit area extent is dependent upon the degree of heterogeneity out in the field. And I'll talk about this a little bit further later on, but it's not a function of the number of increments that you collect in the field, and we'll talk about that in a bit. So let's move on to slide number 12 and look at a decision unit for a demolition area. So again, we have our area of interest. We've designated our decision unit, and it's roughly a 50 by 50 meter area. Again, within the sampling unit, or within the decision unit, there are some items of interest, in this case, craters. And so what we've done here is we've established a number of sampling units that are 10 by 10 meter in size across the entire decision unit. And one thing to note is that the sampling unit results are not directly comparable to the decision unit results because the scale of the samples are different. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, too, as well. So in terms of the decision unit, the objective might be to determine if the concentrations are above some sort of threshold concentration, an action level, or some other criteria. And then the SU objective would be to assess the concentration of the residue in a specific area, in this case, individual craters. One thing to note with the way this particular SU has been, SUs have been laid out, is that if you shifted the SU, say, to the right, some of the craters would shift in or out of an individual SU. So how you lay out things can have some bearing on the outcome of your results. And then the little squiggly pattern in the upper left just show replicate samples being collected with the ISM methodology. And I'll go into that in two slides from now. So let's go to slide 13. And we're going to look at a decision unit for a small arms range. And if we look at the upper left, typically a small arms range has a firing point and then a range floor. And then the dotted line represents the targets. And then typically there's some sort of berm face behind the targets. So oftentimes we'll want to have three decision units, the firing point, the range floor, and the berm face. And if we look at the photo on the lower right, in the lower left-hand corner, you'll see a gravelly area. That's the firing point. The grassing area is the range floor. You can see the targets, and then behind the targets is the berm. In some situations, if you look at the photograph at the top, on older ranges, the berms are oftentimes difficult to find. In this particular case, it took us a couple hours to find the berm, and we really never found where the firing points were laid out. And then the diagram in the lower left just shows the incremental sampling methodology. And in this particular case, there are actually two decision units at the firing point. So one decision unit laid out in front of the firing point and one's laid out behind the firing point. Again, it just depends on, what your objectives are. And again, the squiggly pattern, I'll get into that in the next slide, is just the incremental sampling methodology. So for this particular site, the DU objective might be to determine the concentration of metals, particularly on the berm face, and then propellant at the firing point. So let's go on to slide 14 and talk about incremental sampling methodology a little bit. So again, ISM both includes field aspects as well as sample preparation in the laboratory. The slide depicts a typical DU where a number of increments are collected. So the increments are the little X's, the little circles, and the little triangles. And typically what we're doing is we're collecting a systematic random sample. So what we do is we go out in the field, we mark our DU with some sort of flagging, typically the four corners. If needed, we'll lay out markers at the end of particular grid to kind of orientate ourselves in the field. Oftentimes we don't do that. We know what number of increments we want to collect in the field, and then we pace down one side of the DU boundary to get an idea of what our spacing needs to be between increments so that we can collect the total number of increments in our decision unit. So if we look at the little red circle in the upper left, That's where we start at. We pick a systematic random location in our grid, which is kind of in our mind. Then we take three or four paces, move into the next grid, collect an increment, throw it in the bag, do the same thing, take three or four steps, move into the next grid, collect an increment, throw it in the bag. Do that until we reach the boundary of the DU, step over, and then go back and repeat the process until the whole area has been sampled. Now, the X's and the O's and the triangles actually here represent three independent replicate samples that are collected from the decision unit. So in this case, all the red circles would be going into the same sample bag, and that would be the sample. All the black X's go into another bag, and all the triangles go in another bag. When collecting replicate samples, you could do them all at the same time, or you could collect them sequentially, one after the other. You could collect them all in the same pattern, you know, moving from the top down, or in the case shown here, the black X's are collected 90 degrees to the other samples. So typically we collect three replicates because we want to get some idea on the precision of our sample result. It provides us some idea what the total sample error is. But once we have our individual replicates, then each sample is processed independently. We then collect a subsample to build our digestion aliquot, or if we're sampling for energetics, for extraction. And then we obtain three independent analytical results for that decision unit. Again, there's a detailed discussion of ISM in the ITRC website. There's a document there that you can download and obtain additional information. So let's move on to slide 15. And one of the questions that typically we are asked is, you know, how much mass should I collect, or how many increments should I collect? And basically the size of the sample, or the number of increments that are collected, is a function of the spatial heterogeneity of the contaminant of interest within your DU. So if you have greater degree of heterogeneity, then you need to have a larger sample and have more increments in your sample. So samples must have sufficient mass to include all the constituents in the same proportions as the soil surface. So basically what you're trying to do is your bag or your jar container of sample, if you repeatedly sample that, you should be getting the same result as what's out there in the field. One note is Krell typically recommends including vegetation in the sample. That's contrary to some programs. At least for the energetics, we haven't found that to be an issue in terms of the analysis or the processing steps. And I've talked with some other commercial analytical laboratories, and it doesn't appear to be an issue either. So in terms of increments, Krell recommends a minimum of 30 increments or aliquots, and that's consistent with what the ITRC recommends as well. Typically, we collect 50 to 100 increments in the field, and the reason we do that is we feel that if you collect that many increments, most of the time you're going to achieve whatever precision criteria that you've selected at the start of the project, and that avoids the need to go out and resample again. In some situations, we found that 100 increments is not satisfactory, specifically on impact areas. So in that situation, either more increments are needed, or a larger mass of sample is needed. In some situations, it may not even be possible to meet whichever your target objective is, might be. But that would be pretty rare. Again, for energetic chunks on the field, we typically don't collect those. If we're interested in that information, we have the EOD personnel. Those are the range safety personnel. We'll have them pick up the chunks and weigh them for us in the field and provide us the weight of the sample. If you're interested in identification of the chunks, you could use X-ray or chemometric test kits to identify the constituents of interest. But typically we don't bring back the energetic chunks because we know it's 100% of whatever it is. And also there's safety concerns and transportation concerns. So move on to slide 16. Another question that we often get is, well, how deep of the sample should be collected. In regards to the research that we've done at firing points, energetic residues are associated with nitrocellulose propellants. That includes the nitroglycerin and the DNT, and this material remains at the surface. In the impact area, the residues are a function of the lower detonations or rupture grounds. And the bulk of this material, the RDX, the HMX, TNT, and any transformation products, again, remain at the surface. And our research has shown is that a sampling depth of 2.5 to 5 centimeters is recommended for an active range. If you have an older range, there may be some reworking of the material deeper into the soil profile. And also, there are exceptions such as demolition and hand grenade ranges where they often come in and fill in the craters with fill, or they may rework the range. So in that situation, you might need to collect a sample over a larger depth interval or at a greater depth. And then ranges with water-saturated soils or sediments, you might need to use a different depth interval. So the little graph on the right just shows some results for this particular core sample that was collected. We had 7.8 parts per million in the 0 to 1 centimeter sample, and then 1.2 parts per million, what's referred to as the root zone, 1 to 3 centimeters, and then non-detect in the mineral soil, 3 to 10 centimeters. This is typical to what we've seen both for firing points and impact areas. In older ranges, you could get some dissolution of the explosives material, such as RDX or TNT, and movement down through the soil. What we found is the mass of that material is so small relative to the soil mass that you won't see it, so you'll get a non-detect. Let's move on to the next slide, slide 17. In terms of tools, little X show over the shovel shows that type of device is typically not recommended. It does, you know, yield good results in terms of being able to collect a sample in non-cohesive soils such as sand and gravels. But the problem is, you can see it's a little divot there, as the sample tool yields a biased sample. You have more sample in your sample container from your scoop at the top or at the surface, and at the pointy end of the tool, you get very little sample. So you're top heavy in terms of your sample. So generally what we recommend is some sort of coring device that provides a plug-shaped sample. This type of shape is the preferred shape based on sample theory. Another advantage is that it typically provides a consistent depth interval that you're collecting and a more consistent volume of material from increment to increment. So, you know, say the core barrel is holding 200 grams of material. Every time you get an increment, you're getting close to 200 grams, whereas with the shovel type device, you can be all over the place in terms of the mass of the soil that's being obtained, so you could be biasing your sample. And the ITRC document, the ISM-1, has a lengthy discussion of different types of sampling tools. So let's go on to slide 18 and talk about some recommendations for training ranges. So basically, you start off at the project planning stage and defining your areas based on functional use, if it's known. So that could be something like, you know, low, medium, or high potential impact, or it could be, you know, the impact area between the firing fans, within the firing fans, and maybe, you know, immediately around your targets in your central impact area. And then you want to divide these functional areas into DUs based on your sampling objectives. And then you collect your multi-increment samples from within each DU using a systematic random pattern. And then typically we collect three replicate samples to provide an estimate of the uncertainty or the total error associated with the sample. So that includes both the field sampling and the sample processing. In situations where you expect a high degree of heterogeneity, three increments or three replicates may not be sufficient. You may need to collect more. And if you have a site where you have a consistent lithology, similar type of training activity, you know, similar type of heterogeneity, and you're collecting a lot of DU samples, say you're collecting 20 DU samples, then you may not need to collect three replicates for, you know, each decision unit. working on that situation, maybe selecting two of the decision units and collecting replicates within those might be sufficient. Again, you have to decide this up front at the project planning stage. Again, no chunk sampling, bad news. So, you know, if you needed information on the chunks, again, have the EOD personnel weigh those out in the field. And if you need to identify them, use the X-ray or the chemometric test kits. Slide 19, and I will turn it over to Mary Ann.
Okay. At the analytical lab, a relatively small mass of soil, literally a few grams, is generally used to estimate the mean concentration in a field sample that is likely to be a kilogram or more, which in turn ideally represents the mean concentration in the decision unit. So in other words, decisions are made for tons and tons of soil based on a concentration estimate from just a few grams of soil. Over the last two decades, we have used field-contaminated soil to optimize the laboratory processing procedures that allow us to represent a large field sample with just a few grams. These procedures evolved over the years. It was based on soils initially from Army ammunition plants, and then as time went on, to soils from military training ranges. And these procedures were eventually promulgated under Method 8330D. The physical properties of explosives fortunately allow us to process samples such that subsampling uncertainty can be minor. And the steps are listed here. The processing involves air drying. That's to arrest or minimize microbial activity. It also allows you to sieve the soil and remove the oversized fraction. And then grinding is done using a puck mill, which I'll talk about in the next slide. But after it's ground, the sample is spread into a thin layer, and then we acquire an analytical subsample by taking many increments through the thickness of the layer. And then finally, we extract the analytes of interest from the soil using an appropriate solvent, in this case, acetonitrile. And the analysis is done by HPLC, UV, and in recent years, substituting the mass spectrometer for the UV detector. Slide 20. Slide 20 shows an image of the grinding step using a puck mill. The original method 8330 specified that the sample be ground with a mortar and pestle such that it would pass through a 30 mesh sieve. However, when we took several subsamples from a sample that was processed in this way, especially if it was a sample from a training range that had detonation residue, we would more than likely find several subsamples with similar concentration and then a few samples that yielded a much, much higher concentration estimate. Recall that the explosives are solid and that each field sample likely contains very few energetic particles or propellant fibers compared to the soil matrix. So this was in the late 90s. I took a class from Chuck Ramsey and I explained this problem to him. And he said I had two options, increase the subsample mass or decrease the particle size of the sample. Well, neither option was particularly attractive. A larger subsample would require more acetonitrile. Acetonitrile is expensive. It would create more hazardous waste. The other approach is particle size reduction by machine grinding. This procedure has been used for many, many years by USGS and in the mining industry, but it was certainly not a routine procedure for environmental labs. So needless to say, I was skeptical. Energetics are shock sensitive. They're thermally labile. But I always know that assumptions can be wrong. And so Chuck and I agreed to do a collaborative study with some field samples from a hand grenade range. So on the next slide, 21, is a table that shows the estimates of RDX and TNT in subsamples of a sieve soil from a hand grenade range and the effect of machine grinding. You'll see the blue fonts are the minimums in each column. The red fonts are the maximum. So the first attempt I made to decrease the uncertainty was to increase the subsample size. The original method 8330 called for a 2-gram subsample, so we increased it to 50 grams. As you can see, that did not help. However, if you look at the column or the data under the machine grinding to reduce the particle size, which makes many, many more particles, That was successful at reducing the subsampling uncertainty. And these data were published in 2002, and since that time, we have over a decade's worth of data from training ranges all the way across North America and now Europe that grinding does indeed significantly reduce the subsampling uncertainty without analyte loss. However, the grinding must be done properly. You need to use a puck mill. The sample must not be allowed to heat. We grind for 1 minute for the explosives, which are crystalline, and we grind for 5 1-minute cycles for soils with propellant residue. The propellant is fibrous and requires more grinding. So we move on to slide 22. You can see the soil subsampling procedure. The soil is ground in 500-gram batches if you use a standard bowl. Bigger bowls are available for larger samples if you can lift them. But a sieve sample may require several, a sieve field sample may require several batches. So the ground sample, as the batches come off, is evenly spread to a thin layer. Then we build the 10-gram subsample, and we make the subsample with at least 30 increments that are sampled through the thickness of the sample. So the image at the lower right shows a simple way to ensure that you have an adequate number of increments. And they're taken basically in the same procedure that Jay described for field samples. However, in this case, 30 increments is generally adequate. We've already reduced the heterogeneity of the sample by grinding. So the particles are all now similar in size. We move to slide 23. Question is, can a 10-gram subsample represent a larger than kilogram field sample? And indeed it can. These data, Alan Hewitt did this study, and it shows he did this experiment using field-contaminated soils from a demolition range in an impact area. He processed the soil according to the methods that we just outlined and took triplicate 10-gram subsamples for solvent extraction. He also extracted the remaining field sample. So that was almost 1,800 grams for the demolition range and 1,300 grams from the impact area sample. And as you can see, the concentration estimates are essentially the same. So we have an advantage here in the lab where we can extract the whole sample. Unfortunately, we can't do that in the field very easily. So we go on to slide 24. Extraction kinetic studies were conducted many years ago, again using field-contaminated soils, originally from arsenals, and that showed that equilibration time varied with the concentration and with the soil. Equilibration was achieved rapidly for higher concentration soils, that especially if they were sandy, and more slowly for low-concentration clay-type soils. The 18-hour time was sufficient for most soils, and that allowed samples to be extracted overnight. Now, the 18-hour extraction is not necessarily a burden. The solvent can be added to the subsamples in the afternoon, and then the extracts are prepared for analysis following morning. We frequently get inquiries about alternative extraction procedures, and we're given data based on spike soils. Now, if you're going to develop or test an alternative extraction procedure, I must emphasize that you need to use field-contaminated soils. Spike soils are just not adequate for solvent kinetic extraction studies. Okay, slide 25. This lists the SW846 methods for explosives. We've already mentioned method 8330B. We developed method 8095 in the late 1990s when we needed lower detection limits for some of our research. It is a gas chromatography method with an electron capture detector. It's easily used for nitroaromatics. However, nitramines and nitrate esters do require significant maintenance, especially of the injection port liner. We found it to be an excellent method for confirmation, but it's not particularly rugged for routine analysis. And as far as we know, it's not commercially available. However, it is a viable method. Slide 26. This shows one of our actual HPLCs in a typical chromatogram. The HPLC determinations are made on an analytical column. This particular one is a C8 column. We chose it because it resolves the isomers of DNT and amino DNTs. Remember that identification is based on retention time. So all determinations must be confirmed, which is generally done by a second column that has a different retention order, as outlined in method 8330B. Slide 27, it shows a chromatogram from the GAS the GC-ECD. You'll see the GC provides excellent peak resolution. Separation here is based on vapor pressure, and detection is based on electron capture by the nitro groups. So that's what makes it an excellent confirmation method for the HPLC UV that is based on polarity and based on UV absorption. Slide 28, just to review, the HPLC, these are the advantages of the two methods. The HPLC is more rugged. It is basically the workhorse method. The GC, it provides lower detection limits. However, it's better for special circumstances and for confirmation because it is a less rugged method. And then slide 29, some important considerations for determination of munition constituents. The entire sample must be processed. If it takes a kilogram of soil to represent a decision unit, then the entire kilogram must be analyzed or processed so that an analytical subsample can be taken and still represent that field sample, which is representing your decision unit. Secondly, this seminar is focusing on sampling. Now, that's appropriate because sampling is indeed the greater source of uncertainty than the actual analysis at the instrument. Method 8330B was developed using field-contaminated soils, which showed that solvents, such as methylene chloride, that is appropriate for semi-volatiles, is not efficient at extracting explosives from soil. And lastly, I reiterate, all determinations must be confirmed. With that, we'll go to slide 30, with Harry for a case study.
Thanks, Marianne. The next case study we're going to look at is one in Utah. This is a fairly large size open burn, open detonation unit. Under facilities that do repeated detonations for disposal, they have to have permits under the RCRA program, under RCRA Subpart X, to evaluate ongoing monitoring. This particular one is about 1,500 acres in Intermountain West in Utah, at Utah Test and Training Range. It's been operated for a number of years, and they do demilitarization of large rocket motors since the early 90s, and their permit for the record permit was finalized in 2003. This is the only facility right now in the U.S. where a large missile motor is greater than 10,000 pounds net explosive weight are destroyed, and a lot of that has to do with having adequate buffer zones around the site where the detonation occurred because of the blast wave effects. And also it tends to be done in the Intermountain West, which has lower infiltration and precipitation. Let's go to slide 31. Just a couple examples of the type of rocket motors that are destroyed at the Utah Test and Training Range. The one on the left is a Titan booster rocket segment. The one on the right is a C4 motor from submarine motors that the Navy utilizes. You can see for scale there the pictures of the individuals. These are fairly large items here. The ones on the right have each segment there is about 13,000 pounds net explosive weight. These type of rocket motors typically are based on either two types of chemical constituents. What's referred to as class 1.3 rocket motor propellant is typically a combination of ammonium perchlorate and aluminum with a plastic binder. Another type, which is typical, which you see on the C4 Trident motor, and then the one on the left, the Titan one, is based on what is referred to as class 1.1, and that is ammonium perchlorate, aluminum, plastic binder, and then other energetics such as HMX and occasionally nitroglycerin are included in those. So it depends on the specific composition of the item in terms of what it needs to be sampled for. Let's go to slide 32. Like to sort of reinforce the concept here on what's referred to as low order versus high order detonation. The one on the these photos are taken about a mile and a half away from the detonation, so you can get an idea of scale here. The one on the right where the Trident missile motor has milliseconds into detonation here, you see the shockwave propagating across the desert floor in a fairly tight fireball. This was referred to as high-order detonation, where maximum explosive yield occurs for the given amount of material there. In contrast to that, the one on the left you see there is you see more smoke plume. You see individual pieces of the propellant being expelled out of that. That's you get much lower shock waves, and it burns at a much lower combustion efficiency than the one on the right. And this has implications with regard to the level of residual contamination from these type of disposal practices, which I'll show you a little bit later here. Let's go to slide 33. I mentioned some of the previous background on this particular site. It requires a RCRA Part B permit to assess human health and ecological risk as an ongoing operation. Discrete sampling events occurred on four different occasions prior to 2004, and then the shift was done to incremental sampling in 2005 and 2006. And the purpose of the sampling is to try to get repeatable data that reflects the site conditions. There's, in this particular case, there are 40 sampling areas, 31 DUs or sampling grids, several non-operational areas, and then some background samples. The size of the sampling unit in this particular case was 100 by 100 meters, or about approximately 2 acres in size, and it was superficial samples of 1 to 2 meters in depth. And then also field triplicates were done to evaluate reproducibility. And then also they split samples between commercial laboratory, which is the Vern Trent Lab in Denver, and the Krell Government Lab in New Hampshire to evaluate differences between the laboratories. Let's go into slide 34. This shows a comparison of the RDX sampling results from the previous discrete sampling that was conducted on the left, and then the incremental sampling methodology that was done in 2005 and 2006. In this particular situation, RDX is used in the C4 in the donor charge, so the amount of RDX relative to the amount of propellant in the missile motor is fairly small. What you see generally on the discrete sample is there's fairly low detections on RDX historically, and some of that sampling didn't necessarily cover the decision units where it was previously sampled. In comparison to that, if you look at the results from the incremental sampling, generally, you found low and repeatable non-detects on a large portion of it, and then you saw some detections in several of the grids sort of away from the central point of detonation on that. And so it showed basically consistent sampling results between the 2 years there, and then also you get a much higher sampling density within each sampling unit or decision unit. So when you have relatively low levels of contaminant, you generally get repeatable low levels of contamination. Let's go ahead into slide 35. This shows the HMX sampling results. As you recall, I mentioned that the Class 1.1 rocket motors can have a significant amount of HMX in there in addition to the perchlorate. And you see the historic values there for HMX off the pad and outside the sampling grids show a more elevated level of HMX based on what is in the rocket motors. What you see when the incremental sampling methodology was implemented in 2005 and 2006 is you essentially get repeated and elevated detections in each one of the sampling units or decision units there, and so it shows much better sampling density across the whole area that's being utilized for detonation operations, and you get repeated detections. So in general, you get a much more consistent sampling results grid to grid and year to year. And let's go ahead and go to slide 36. In addition, a number of these rocket motors contain perchlorate as well as the other energetic materials. You see the discrete sampling results from 2005 on the left, and similar pattern for perchlorate as what we saw for HMX is when a higher density sampling grid was implemented there in 2005 and 2006, you see much more repeated detections across a number of the sampled units. So it provides a much better estimate of mass loading and concentration within each sampling unit. Let's go to slide 37. In addition to looking at concentrations in the DUs or sampling units, there was split sampling done on these to evaluate difference between laboratory. The STL commercial lab and the Krell government lab here showed good repeat precision on the samples that were conducted, the three replicates that Jay previously described. And so you saw a good agreement between completely separate replicates here for lab analysis. STL's detection limit was slightly higher than the Krell one, so you see non-detect, but they're near detection limits. So even near detection limits, you can get good repeatable results if the entire methodology is followed. And you saw the same pattern also with on HMX and also in perchlorate. There weren't split sampling in perchlorate between different laboratories, but the replicate precision on the perchlorate was also quite good. And let's go to slide 38. This is shows the sampling results comparison between the 2005 and 2006 results. The slide I showed previously of the low-order detonation on the rocket motor occurred between these two sampling events. And one of the things you see between the 2005 and 2006 sampling event is an increase of more than an order of magnitude of the residual perchlorate levels at the surface in the same decision unit or same sampling unit. And the precision was quite good under both years. This essentially shows the effect of low-order detonation of the large rocket motor with the increase of perchlorate levels from a year-to-year sampling event, but precision was also good here. So this is would be readily attributable to the disposal activities versus just sampling heterogeneity. Let's go to slide 39. The incremental sampling methodology in this particular case was successful in defining spatial distribution of the energetics for the items that were destroyed. The year-to-year repetition was good. The year-to-year, within-year repetition, repetition was good, and this may allow for relaxed sampling frequency on their RCRA permit. The other consideration, too, here is on exposure port concentration. Typically, those are based on an upper confidence limit on mean concentration, and oftentimes the precision on that is very wide or the uncertainty. And what this allowed here is much better replication of sampling results year to year and within each sampling decision unit. So it provides a more accurate estimate of potential soil exposure levels. In addition, it provides a better estimate of total mass in place here to look at potential migration to groundwater or other pathways as well. One item to note here is that since this particular site is located in the Intermountain West, it has fairly low rainfall and a fairly deep depth to groundwater. Oftentimes in those situations, the issue of groundwater contamination may be less of an issue, but if the same particular disposal unit was located in areas of high infiltration or rainfall, those levels of perchlorate would be a potential risk to migration to groundwater, as I think Jay will show you a little bit of example later on here. And the next one, we're at slide 40, and I believe Jay or Mary Ann will be discussing
okay.
this one.
All right. I'm going to present some case studies of sampling results from active training ranges. And we're going to start with firing points. At firing points, the firing of a weapon can disperse solid propellant residue, and also excess propellant can be burned, and in the U.S., that's burned on the ground, which can also leave residue. And firing points are relatively small in size and can be repeatedly used, so that could, again, concentrate the residue. Slide 41 is a review. It shows images of actual propellant residue that we collected from firing points of various types of ordnance. And as you can see, the residues consist of discrete fibers or fragments of partially consumed propellant. We've We find the percentage of DNT or nitroglycerin in the residue is essentially the same as the unfired propellant. And note here also the nitrocellulosis fiber is fibrous. It does not grind easily, and thus again the 5 times 60 second grinding procedure that we mentioned earlier. Slide 42. In the early 2000s, we were asked by U.S. Army Alaska to develop a sampling method to monitor the accumulation of training range residue on land that was leased from the Bureau of Land Management but was used for military training. And we tested, that's when we started testing the various sampling strategies, including the multi-increment sampling. Our objective was to estimate the mean concentration of 2,4-DNT or NG in the surface soil at the firing points, and we wanted to know if it was accumulating over the years. Slide 43, this shows all the data from 2003 to 2009 where we collected increments across an entire 105 millimeter firing point. The surface of this particular firing point was glacial till. It was covered by a thin layer of silt, and that required us to use the scoop rather than the core. And again, recall that the scoop is not ideal. It's more likely to obtain samples that are inconsistent depth, and it can favor the surface soil, which has a higher concentration. And basically, you make little divots, as Jay showed in his in an image. That's instead of the rather nice little even cores that you could get with the core that have the same depth and diameter. That's the desired geometry. Nevertheless, samples taken through the years show that there's no evidence of accumulation of dinitrotoluene at the current rate of training. Over the years, we found essentially around 1 to 2 part per million DNT in the surface soil. So this met our objective. Slide 44, we've also studied different training activities to assess the mass of residue from different types of ordnance. And the two that are the worst are shown here, the 40 millimeter machine gun and the AT-4 rocket. You can have thousands of part per million of nitroglycerin. And in the case of the rocket, that's behind the firing line. In contrast, results from studies from the 155 millimeter howitzer, which is a huge weapon, essentially leaves no significant residue. Slide 45, this is a study from Alan Hewitt's ESTCP project where we put a 40 meter by 40 meter decision unit in a mortar firing point, and we compared three conventional sampling strategies that are known as the wheel, box, and discrete, and we compared that to 100 increment samples. In case you're not familiar, the wheel sample consists of 7 increments. They're of equal mass to a discrete sample, and they're combined to form one sample, and the increments are taken from the center and then 6 equally spaced locations on the perimeter of a circle that has a 0.6 meter radius. The box sampling design has only 5 increments that are combined to form the bulk sample. The increments are taken at the center and then 5 meter distance from the center in the 4 cardinal directions. Locations of the center points are chosen randomly. The discrete samples also are chosen from random locations. And then there were 10 multi-increment samples collected by combining evenly spaced increments across the entire decision unit using a 3 centimeter diameter core. And for this study, replicates were taken for each strategy. I remember in the real world, only 1 or perhaps 2 samples would be used to represent a given decision unit. And as you can see, the 100 increment samples cluster around the grand mean. Grand mean was determined by summing all the soil that we collected, that was 21 kilograms, and all the nitroglycerin that we detected, and that yielded a mean concentration of about 10 milligram per kilogram. And we've sampled this. This area was chosen because we knew their previous studies. had indicated there was detectable nitroglycerin. We wanted to do these studies where we could detect something. And the mean concentration in 100 increment samples over the years between 2005 and 2009 had been between 4 and 13 milligrams per kilogram. Slide 46, in the next series of slides, we'll present case studies from active ranges with from decision units that clearly had explosive residues. In fact, they had solid residue visible on the surface of the soil. The first one, a decision unit, this is slide 47. The decision unit was centered on the scattered area of high explosive chunks. This was from a single detonation event. It's a 20 meter by 20 meter decision unit. Slide 48 shows all the different sampling strategies. Again, each orange flag marks the position of a deposit of solid Comp B. We did the wheel box discrete sampling, and in this case, we actually took 200 discrete samples. We did 10 100 increment samples, and then we came back in 2008, did some more sampling, one of which included subsurface samples from one of the 100 increment samples. Slide 49 shows the results of the sampling effort. We collected 38 kilos. This is for 2007. We collected 38 kilograms in all, yielding a mean concentration or a grand mean of 49 milligrams per kilogram. Recall that this decision unit was likely contaminated by only one detonation event. And even though the decision unit is within the scatter area of the Comp B residue, the wheel, box, and discrete sampling designs had non-detect concentrations. In fact, for the discrete samples, the median was the detection limit. 134 out of the 200 discrete samples were essentially below the detection limit. So again, recall that any single sample may have been used to represent this decision unit in the real world. And we can see again that the 100 increment samples cluster around the grand mean. We're not diluting out the hotspot. When we first started telling people about they need to take increments across the decision unit, we heard that over and over again. You're going to miss the hot spot. Well, indeed not, as shown by these data. Subsurface samples were non-detect when in the surface sample that had about 5 milligrams per kilogram. Slide 50, a decision unit at a demolition training area. This is where engineers use C4 in practice, blowing up what could be a bridge and things like that. It was a 30 meter by 30 meter decision unit centered on an area with visible C4 residue. Again, we did the wheel box discrete samples. And slide 51 shows the results. This demolition area was likely contaminated by several detonation events, so the RDX was spread over the entire decision unit. And again, of the sampling designs, we see here that the 100 increment samples yield concentrations clustering around the grand mean, which in this case was 21 milligrams per kilogram. Slide 52, these results are consistent with what was seen at the Mass Military Reservation, where a groundwater plume originated from the demolition area. RDX concentrations were found about 400 micrograms per liter near the source, and these were attributed to detonations at C4. Slide 53, universal findings. Again, this is for active ranges. Most of the impact area are indeed not contaminated with energetics. They may look bad in the impact area with the craters and the targets and the scrap, but indeed, it's only where there's chunks of explosives, they're highly localized, with elevated soil concentrations near low order or partial detonations. The explosive residues can be located anywhere within the impact area, not necessarily near targets, because targets can be moved over the years. We generally find RDX, HMX, TNT, in some cases the amino DNTs, which are microbial transformation products of TNT. Perchlorate originating from spotting charges may be present, although it can dissolve very rapidly and migrate. And just to mention that white phosphorus can be persistent in wetlands and cause an ecological risk to waterfowl. And again, want to reiterate about the chunks of explosives. We don't take them off the range. However, we don't ignore them. Depending on the project objectives, we'll ask the EOD escort to weigh the collective mass of the chunks of HE found in the decision unit, and we use a field portable balance. Slide 54, findings from demolition ranges. Again, these are active ranges. There's RDX residues will be detected in any range used since World War II. TNT blocks were used on older ranges for demolition. The surface of demolition ranges can be reworked over the years. Demolitions may have been performed in pits or trenches that were subsequently buried, so the residues can be deeper in the soil profile as a result of that reworking. Demolition ranges can also be used for propellant disposal, and generally inefficient methods are used, such as burning on snow can have occurred, or the propellant may have actually been, C4 may have been used to actually blow up the propellant bags, and what that does is simply scatters the propellant grains around. So we have solid propellant residue in addition to the solid explosive residue. So in the next slide, 55, we'll go to J for small arms ranges and metallic residues.
Thanks, Marianne. So we'll shift gears here a little bit and talk about things that don't go boom. So we're looking at small arms ranges, and what we're seeing on the right is a typical type of projectile ranging from the 9mm pistol up to the 50 cal machine gun. And so the typical metallic residues of interest at small arms ranges are antimony and lead, which make up the core of these projectiles, and then copper and zinc, which is the alloy mixture for the jacket. And then some of the munition items, or most of them have a steel tip, so that's iron and manganese. In some situations, other metals may be of interest, such as tungsten, where the green bullet was used. In this case, the lead antimony core was swapped out with tungsten. And then if you're looking at a shotgun range, arsenic is typically used to harden the shot. So those are the main metals of interest. I oftentimes hear people, you know, wanting to look for chrome and other different types of metals. And from my review of what's in these different types of casing materials, chrome and mercury and some other metals, they're just not present. So, again, I understand the different regulatory environments, and there may be a need to look at expanded target analyte lists, but you know, those constituents I just mentioned are the ones that are present in the casing materials. In addition to the metallic residues, we'll talk a little bit about the propellant compounds. Typically, again, they're nitroglycerin and dinitrocholamine, and that residue is typically found at the firing points. The photos just show some typical small arms ranges. One on the upper left, I think you saw that earlier, is an older range from the 1940s. And then the one at the lower bottom is an active range at Camp Edwards where the soldiers were actually firing that particular day. So let's move on to slide 56. Here's our generic small arms range layout. I shamelessly stole this from the ITRC. They have a document out in 2003 talking about sampling and construction of different types of small arms ranges. Typically, again, you have a firing point. Some propellant residue falls out of the barrel of the gun around the firing point. You have a range floor, and then at some distance you have a target. And typically behind the targets you have an impact berm. In some situations the berm's contiguous all the way across the range. In other situations you might have individual berms behind specific targets. In some situations you have targets at varying distances downrange and berms behind those targets at varying distances. So let's move on to the next slide, slide 57. Look at the composition of propellant in the small arms. Again, typically nitrous cellulose is the main constituent, and then nitroglycerin is typically present. In some formulations, diazine nitrotoluene is present, the 2,4 isomer. If you look down at the table and see the M14 rifle, the 7.62 millimeter round, that has dinitrotoluene. And then typically there are binding agents of different types of phthalates, or in this case, DP diphenylamine. If you look at the photograph at the bottom left, that's a typical variance of the propellant. This is from a 50 cal propellant. This is unfired state, so it's typically a shiny, silvery BB light configuration. And then the photograph on the right is of the same material after it's been fired. The propellant grains become more translucent, more irregular in shape. In some situations, there might be a soot coating on the propellant grain. So let's go on to the next slide, slide 58, and just talk a little bit about milling or grinding, because this question's repeatedly raised. There's recognition that your typical puck mill is composed of metallic components, and so there's this great concern that you're wearing away your puck and bowl and contributing metal into your sample. So we've looked at this particular issue, and so here's data for lead. And what we did here is we collected our sample, and then we sieved it with our number 10 sieve. And so the data you're looking at is the less than 2 millimeter size portion. And then we split that sample in half using a rotary splitter to try to get equivalent samples. So half the sample was unground, and the other half is what we refer to as our milled sample. The milled sample was ground for 5 by 60 seconds. That's the propellant protocol using our steel puck mill. And then all the processing steps, digestion mass, in this case 2 grams, sub-sampling, 20 increments, and the analysis methods were identical. So the only difference between these two sets of results is the milling. We did split the milled sample into two, or into half, and so we collected 15 replicates for what I'm referring to as ground number one and then ground number two. And then for the unground material, we also collected 15 replicates. We analyzed those samples, and then the results are shown up on the screen there. The yellow triangles represent the unground sample. And one of the things that I did was I hypothetically said, well, you know, what would happen if I only had collected 3 replicates? So that if you look at replicate group 1, that's replicates 4, 5, and 7. If you look at the precision of the results, based on an RSD calculation, looks pretty good. If you happen to collect what I called replicate group number 2 and collected replicates for 10, 13, and 15, you'd even see better precision and think, wow, you know, I got really good data here. But in this situation, I took 15 replicates from the sample, and you can see you know, the concentration varies from 3,500 to about 1,000 parts per million. So in actuality, the precision is quite poor. It's well over 100% RSD. So when we milled the sample and analyzed it, if we look at the results for the blue circles, both the solid and the open circles, we can see very good precision. The results are quite tightly clustered, and the RSD in this case is less than 30%. The other thing to note is that the concentration of lead with the milled sample is quite a bit higher. The average concentration is around 2,800 parts per million. And if you look at the concentration of the unground samples, the average concentration is closer to 1,500 parts per million. This is the same observation that we've seen with the energetic materials, where the milled sample typically results in a higher average concentration than the unmilled sample. And no, in this specific case, it's not contamination coming off the puck mill. We've looked at that. There is some lead in the alloy of the grinding apparatus material, but there's not enough lead there to account for the different concentrations here. And then the other question often raised, well, you know, breaking up the natural soil releases lead that's, you know, in the center of the sand grain or whatever. And that issue has actually been looked at, and there's a paper published, and In this particular soil, there's not enough lead in the background sample to account for this. So the increase in lead is just solely a function of increased probability of getting many more lead pieces in your sample that's being digested and analyzed. Whereas the unground sample is kind of hit or miss in terms of the number of particles of lead that are getting into your sample. And I have results for all the other metals of interest, and the pattern is similar as well. So let's move on to slide 59. We'll get into our case studies here. This just shows, again, that some of your small arms ranges can look quite a bit different in terms of their design. The photograph up the left obviously is of an older small arms range, and you have trees growing up through the berm. The photograph at the lower right, you can barely see it, but there's some targets that are further away from the berm face, which is somewhat atypical. Typically, the berm is right up behind the targets, as seen in the range at the lower left, although they're hard to see. And then the photograph on the lower right shows a non-contiguous type of berm. In this case, we have multiple targets at varying distances downrange. I think it went 50 to 100, 200 meters, and so on. So let's go on to the next slide, slide 60, and look at our case study. This is the Bravo Range at Camp Edwards in Massachusetts. So again, we have our firing point. We have a range floor. We have a berm face. The range is 187 meters wide, and then the berm face is about 9.5 meters tall. And this was the first berm that we actually studied, so I have many more decision units than typically what we're collecting now. And then the blue numbers on the figure represent the number of replicate samples that were collected. In addition to those samples, we also collected samples from the bullet pockets. That's the concentrated area of metal mass behind the target. So if they're hitting the target correctly, repeatedly, bullets are impacting the same part of the berm face. And then we also collected samples in between bullet pockets for this particular study. So let's go on to the next slide, slide 61. Let's start at the firing point. And typically, again, nitrocellulose is major component of propellant, but typically it's not an environmental constituent of concern. The other components are nitroglycerin and dinitrotoluene, and again, they're typically found at the firing points. I have some data here from some different small arms ranges. Concentrations range from anywhere from 10 parts per million up to maybe close to 1,000 parts per million. And most of the residue is typically found within 10 meters of the firing line. And the photograph at the right shows the Bravo range at Camp Edwards. If we go to the next slide, slide 62, we can see some data for the site. So I collected replicate samples from the firing point and then two locations on the range floor. Background samples were also collected, and they were non-detect, as you'd expect. Nitroglycerin at the firing point was around 22 parts per million, actually a little bit higher in the first area on the range floor downrange, and then lower as we move down towards the target. Had I designed my decision unit for the firing point a little bit differently and extended it a little bit further downrange, I probably would have expected that the decision unit would have had a little bit higher concentration of nitroglycerin and DNT relative to the next decision unit downrange. Let's go on to the next slide, slide 63. Look a little bit at ISM replicate precision. So this is precision of the field sampling that I'm looking at. Collected two different samples in 2005 and then went back and collected in 2007. The identical field, identical decision unit was sampled, the same methods in the field were used, same equipment, same personnel. And then the preparation procedures and analysis in the lab are exactly the same. So there were three replicate samples collected from the decision unit, denoted as 1, 2, and 3. And then back in the laboratory, we split those replicates, again, into third as well. And you can see that within a sample, like the ABC, there's good replication, good precision. And then if we compare the samples, the 1, 2s, and 3s, Again, the precision is really good for the 2007 or the 2005 sampling event, which is the red bars. Again, we went back in 2007, sampled the same range. There's a little bit greater variability in results. Believe that's a function of transformation of the nitroglycerin in the soil. But again, we have pretty good precision of results for that particular sampling event, although our field or our total error is a little bit higher in 2007 as compared to 2005. No firing occurred between the two sampling events, so you know, the change in concentrations is a function of, we believe, transformation products. So let's go on to the next slide, slide 64, and look at sample precision. So again, this goes back to the question, well, how many increments do we need to collect? We collected samples at the Bravo range that consisted of 15, 30, 50, 100, and 200 increments, and then I did 7 replicates for each grouping of increments. So there were 7 replicate samples collected for the 15 increments and so on. And the data is plotted up here for both nitroglycerin and DNT. And you can see that for our 15 replicate samples, that's the highest error as calculated using the RSD. And then when we go up to 200 increments, our RSD is considerably lower. Again, there's some variability in results. For some reason, with the 30 increment sample, I have better precision than I did with the 50 or 100 increment samples. I'm not sure if that was just pure accident or we happen to be really good at that particular time. Again, your selection of what criteria you use for RSD, depends on what your objectives are. Well, we typically use 30% when we're comparing replicates in the field, and then when we're looking at processing issues in the lab, we typically look at 15%. At some point, I think I mentioned this before, you achieve diminishing returns on increasing the number of increments. So that's going to be a judgment call and based on your expectation of the degree of heterogeneity present at the site. So let's go on to the next slide, slide 65, look at some data. So this is antimony results. Again, we took samples from the firing point down to the burn face, and then we dissected the burn face up into a number of different precision units. Background concentrations were typically somewhere around 7 to 10 parts per million, and the concentration on the range was slightly elevated compared to background, but concentrations were fairly uniform across the site. Antimony makes up about 10% of the alloy composition of the core of the round. So if we move on to the next slide, 66, look at lead. It's a little bit more interesting. So as you expect, you would have lower lead concentrations at the firing point and then increase as you move downrange to the burn face. You do have some lead at the firing point because some of the propellant formulations contain lead stiffenate. And you can see that the concentrations at the firing point are elevated as compared to the background concentration. And then further down range, the lead is probably a function of ricochets off the target, or if you have particularly bad soldier shooting and shooting into the ground, that could be contributing to lead there. And then once you get to the burn face, that's where you expect to have the highest concentrations. There's some variability in concentration across the burn face. We've kind of progressed in our thinking now that when we're sampling small arms range, that a single decision unit across the entire berm is probably sufficient. But there may be situations where you want additional detail and you could divvy up that berm face how you would like. The average concentration of lead in the berm face was 385 parts per million. So you can see that some of the decision units across the berm face varied in comparison to that number. If we switch gears a little bit and look at subsurface soil in slide 67, in this situation I didn't collect ISM samples in terms of multi-increment samples in the field. I collected discrete samples from the core. One of the issues of the berm is, is 25 to 50 centimeters at the top of the berm equivalent to say 25 to 50 centimeters lower down the berm, because you're dealing with a slope phase. So because that issue got a little complicated, we just kept it simple by collecting core samples. What we see here with lead, we see with the other metals, but the concentrations are highest at the surface and generally decrease with increasing depth. I think the deepest sample we collected here was 125 centimeters. One of the cores was getting close to background, but the rest of them weren't quite there yet. We did install tension lysimers at this particular site as well as at other sites, and we have not seen, well, at least at this particular site, we have not seen lead. We've seen a little bit of lead at some of the other sites, but not particularly high concentrations. If we move on to the next slide, slide 68, again, this is just showing compilation of all the metal results of interest. So we have copper, lead, and tungsten plotted on the y-axis on the left, and then we have antimony and zinc on the y-axis on the right. And the trends are the same, highest metal concentrations at the surface, and then a decrease with increasing depth. And typically what we've seen in a variety of different ranges is that you typically reach background around 1 to 2 meters below the surface. But it can vary from site to site. I will point out, too, that, you know, one of the issues with collecting samples with a coring-type device, especially in unconsolidated soils, is material sloughing down into your hole, basically cross-contaminating your sample, so you're getting lead or other metals from the surface deeper in the profile, and gives the appearance that you have contamination deeper than you really do. I've seen this quite a bit, and there's not an easy solution other than, you know, making sure that, you know, surface materials are not falling down your borehole. So let's move on to the next slide, slide 69, in recap here. So what are the successful characterization needs for a small arms range? Again, we're recommending the ISM methodology with 30 increments in the field, similar to what we've recommended for the energetics. I didn't show the data here, but we have a lot of data where we looked at discrete or grab samples and compared them with the ISM samples, and we're not recommending that because you can't achieve representative results with grab or discrete samples, and you can't achieve reproducible results. Field splitting is already known as a no-no, but people still seem to want to do it, and with ISM samples, because you're, you know, getting a larger volume of soil, you're carting a couple kilograms of soil back to the laboratory versus what you've done typically in the past with a couple hundred grams. People are balking at that, but there's no way around the issue. Sample has to be processed in its entirety at the laboratory. So I've even tried using a rotary splitter on the field, and the splits are not the same. So there's no way around the issue until the sample is processed. And so the next step in the processing in the laboratory is sieving the sample. Again, we typically use a number 10 sieve that separates things into the over 2 millimeter size fraction and then the less than 2 millimeter size fraction. Typically, we analyze less than 2. EPA defines soil as being less than 2, so a lot of folks are, you know, discarding the oversized fraction. I would, at the very least, weigh that material out and maybe do some separation so you know what the mass of the soil is, or the, you know, big chunks of rock, and what the mass of the metal is, so you have that information. Right now, I don't have any good recommendations on how to deal with that oversized material, but in discussions that I've had with risk assessors, it's an issue that folks are thinking about, because obviously you're ignoring a sizable portion of the metal mass. Milling necessity or grinding the sample is necessary, especially if you expect that your soil concentrations are going to be at or near some sort of action level. Then that requires you to have a better precision of your data. You know, if you're going out to a small arms range and it's been heavily used and you're expecting high concentrations of lead, then the precision of your sample result, you know, whether it's, you know, 10,000 versus 20,000 is probably not as critical. So then in that situation, you might not need to grind your sample. We've also looked at increasing the digestion mass, both to get around the milling necessity, and in that situation, that doesn't improve things a whole lot. Marianne showed some data earlier for energetics, looking at the same issue. We did see improved precision of results after we milled the sample and increased the digestion mass, but the amount of increase really didn't warrant changes to the methodology as it exists presently. And then the same holds true for digestion time. We've got better results by increasing the digestion time, but the amount of improvement really didn't warrant a change to the methodology. And then finally, we recommend subsampling. Again, this is essentially what you do in the field. Spread out your sample, collect a number of increments, in this case maybe 20, and pool those increments to form your aliquot that you're going to digest. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Harry on slide 70.
Thanks, Jay. Just go over some of the conclusions you've seen from the research that's been done to date on the field demonstrations. One of the things is the ranges in OBOD units have unique patterns of environmental contamination based on the type of releases and training activities and disposal activities that have occurred. I think as you've seen through the examples here, there's a significant amount of heterogeneity based on detonation and combustion effects and based on the chemical characteristics of the materials used in munitions, including the propellants and the explosives. From the other examples, you've seen that there's demonstrated sampling and analytical procedures that have been developed that can increase the representativeness and control the heterogeneity within the sample decision unit or sampling unit. Let's go to slide 71. One of the things that's an important component of developing site planning is to use a technical project planning or systematic project planning process to gather all the historical data that you have or about use and disposal on ranges and OBOD units. Even with this level of planning, oftentimes you'll have historical records that are incomplete, that particularly for disposal, they just didn't keep particularly good records of what they disposed of or total quantities or fillers that were in those items. So particularly on OBOD units, the historical records are often notoriously incomplete. And this part really is what sets up the planning for how you lay out sampling units and decision units, that all the historical data is used, and then also recognizing you have data gaps to develop a conceptual site model that becomes the basis for the sampling units or the decision units that are sampled. And let's go to slide 72. I think as you've seen from some of the examples that the ISM methodology can control accuracy, bias, and precision of sampling within the sampling unit or decision unit. And it's very important that representativeness is obtained through application of all components of the ISM methodology. One of the questions we've often seen is, yeah, we understand why you need to, take more increments in the field and why discrete isn't useful, but you know, the laboratory either doesn't want to grind the sample or mill the sample, or they're going to charge me more money for it. One of the problems that if you take steps out of the ISM methodology, what we've referred to as ISM light, is it degrades data quality that you've moved the field heterogeneity into the laboratory with not addressing that. So the laboratory sub-sampling error still dominates versus the instrumental error, and so it's important that the all steps in the process of the ISM methodology are done, including the laboratory subsampling procedures and the milling or grinding prior to the instrumental analysis. It's the entire process that gives you the accuracy, bias, and precision. If you take parts of that out, it degrades data quality and compromises the process. So all steps in the process are important from a data quality perspective.
And okay.
On to slide 73. Any questions?
Okay, Harry. Okay, thank you very much, Harry. And now we will take questions from the participants. Co-moderator Jean Ballant will provide the questions to the presenters. Also, Doug Maddox with EPA's Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office may assist in questions regarding EPA's policies pertaining to munition sampling. Jean?
Okay, great. Thank you. We do have a number of questions that have been submitted online. I'm going to turn to those in just 1 minute. I want to start first and ask if any of our phone line participants have a question for our speakers. If you are on the telephone line and have a question that you have not already typed up electronically, please take yourself off of mute by hitting #6, and we'd ask that you identify yourself or organization to ask a question out loud. Okay, well, I'm going to start going through some of those electronic questions, and then we'll check back in with the phone line. The first question is coming in from the Department of Defense in Sacramento, California, and they're asking in reference to slide number 11, was there no sampling at the firing point or DU or SU at the firing point? And again, this was in reference to slide number 11.
This is Jay Clausen. This is just a hypothetical example, but yes, in situations where you're looking at a range or a range complex, you know, typically there's going to be samples that are going to be collected at the firing point as well as the impact area.
Great, thank you. Our next question comes in from the Navy out in Norfolk, Virginia, and Jay, this question is also directed at you. They ask, are the chunks of explosives and or metals used quantitatively?
They can be, so that's why typically we have the EOD personnel collect those chunks and weigh them out in the field. Again, that's getting more into a risk assessment type of question in terms of how do you deal with that. You know, my thought is that information should be collected, and then, you know, if folks need it, like risk assessment, or if, you know, somebody's going to be doing some computer modeling and they need to do, you need to have some loading type information, then you have that information. Whereas if you just ignore that material out in the field and then, you know, you're down the road and you have to do some modeling or, you know, you need some additional information for your risk characterization, then you don't have the information. So it doesn't take too much effort to collect that information while you're out in the field.
Okay, great. Our next question also comes in from Sacramento, California, and they ask in reference to slide 14, are the, quote, increments the same as, quote, field replicates?
Good question. Yeah, there seems to be confusion on that. So the increments are different. So if you look at slide 14, you have your decision unit boundary, which is, you know, the area in black. The increments are what make up your sample. So if, again, you look at all the blue triangles on the slide, each one of those triangles represents an individual increment. So you collect an increment from one location, walk a few steps to the next, collect another increment, throw it in your bag, walk a few more steps, collect another increment, and throw it in your bag, and it's the culmination of all those increments that yields your sample for the decision unit. So a replicate sample is basically just another sample that's consisting of a number of increments.
Okay. Our next question comes in from San Diego, California. And they ask, is there a standard for estimating or weighing, if it can be moved, the energetic chunks in the SUs? The data could be used to scope future evaluations and development of cost estimates. Jay, Perry, Marianne, anyone have a comment if there's a standard for estimating or weighing the energetic chunks in the SUs?
Gene, this is Harry. I'll sort of take a shot at that. I mean, one of the issues here on the chunk material is it's reactive material. If you, in sufficient quantity, this material will detonate if it's initiated. So it's a safety issue, and typically the chunks on site will be, you know, thermally destroyed on site, you know, once they're all collected. The other thing is there are analytical methods that can be used on site. A couple of more mentioned, Jay. X-ray is one, which is a white test that identifies what the specific compound is, whether it's composition B, whether it's RDX, whether it's TNT only. And also there are colorimetric methods on site that are an acetone extraction, colorimetric tests that are EPA field methods that can be used to identify it. And then I think, as Marianne also indicated, you can simply weigh the total mass of the material. So
yeah,
it's primarily a safety issue of not shipping chunk explosives to the laboratory, or that the laboratory is not grinding these oversized materials.
Yeah, and then in terms of whether or not you should use that information, again, that's going to be up to your risk assessor to make that determination. Whether, you know, is it just important to go by what's, you know, in your soil sample result, or should you somehow add, you know, the mass of material that you have for the solid residue to that soil? You know, that just depends, I guess, on different individuals' perspectives. So I'll punt that to the risk assessors.
Okay, great. Thank you. Our next question is coming from the Army Corps of Engineers in St. Louis, Missouri. And they ask, is there a report available detailing the effectiveness of grinding with a puck mill on analytical consistency?
Hi, this is Mary Ann. Yes, there is a technical report, a CREL technical report. The title of the report is about extraction kinetics, but within that report, we do have studies on the grinding. And it should be in the reference list for the document on which this seminar is based. And if you can't find it, just send me an email and I'll send you a copy.
Great, thank you. And we'll be sure to cover everybody's contact information before we close out today. We'll also be able to post any related references as well to a resources page for today's seminar to download. So I'm going to go ahead and continue on with the online questions. You can continue to type those up. Our next question is coming in from Greenville, South Carolina, and they ask, what was the frequency of the field triplicate sample collection for the case study? But they didn't specify which case study. So I don't know if you guys can go through each case study. Again, it was, what was the frequency of field triplicate sample collection for your case studies?
Well, I can just speak generically for the CREL research. Typically what we do is we collect replicates on everything we do. So we collect, you know, three replicates. That includes, you know, energetic studies that we've done with propellants and explosives in the impact area, and that includes the metal stuff that we've done. In some situations, in specific studies, we've actually collected more replicates. I'm not sure. I think Harry's case study, I think that was also replicates of three. Is that right, Harry?
Yeah, Gene, just to kind of follow up on sort of a, I'll call it production mode type sampling versus research, you may do it on something on the order of, say, one. And it depends on how many decision units you have total. And what the replicate sampling really is designed to do is a couple things. One, to evaluate precision, and then it's also a quality assurance check on the entire process if you have a certain target goal on precision to make sure you have enough increments and the entire process is under control. And that particular case, you might do triplicates on a percentage or even all of the decision units, depending how many decision units you have and what level of precision goals you have. So it varies based on individual sites and what the goals are for that particular sampling effort.
Okay, great. Thank you. This next one is a bit of an observation, and it might go a little bit beyond the scope of today's talk, but I'm going to read through some of what they're discussing and then ask if you can comment, because they are looking for some discussion if you have information on the topic. So this is coming from Atlanta, Georgia, and they mention that more and more small arms ranges are being turned over for unrestricted public use. And the current EPA guidance calls for sample fractions that are greater than 2 millimeters to be weighed and set aside, and then the soluble lead particles that stick to hands are characterized and analyzed. They also go on to say that lead shot has been frequently shown to be directly ingested by curious children, and they reference a case where this has taken place in Florida. They mention that the important exposure pathway is not addressed in the current EPA guidance, and they think that there's a risk for children because of this. And they'd ask if you have some discussion to talk about it or reference guidance on the qualitative and quantitative evaluation and reporting of those that are greater than the 2 millimeter fraction. And again, if it goes beyond the scope of today, that's okay, but feel free to comment if you can.
Dean, I'll take a shot at that one. I mean, I think one of the things in reference to small arms range, the other type besides, you know, projectile bullets are trap and skeet ranges that have lead shot. And a lot of times the percentage of the lead shot that's above 2 millimeters is the majority of it. So if you sieve it to 2 millimeters, that material would not necessarily end up in the undersized material. The other thing typically on the oversized material, if you analyze total lead in that oversized, a lot of times the levels are fairly high. In lead, you may be at 10 or 20,000 parts per million. And then the other issue is with regard to characterization for hazardous waste, there's a standardized test for lead, TCLP, that's used to determine whether the material is hazardous waste or not. Oftentimes, lead shot itself that's analyzed, oversized, will fail TCLP, so it's classified as hazardous waste, and that has to be treated in a certain manner, where the material, sometimes the undersize, may not be classified as hazardous waste. So the issue of oversized material on site-specific conditions really needs to be taken into consideration, and one thought may be is you may need to fractionate it into different size fractions and analyze those separately, particularly if you're dealing with small arms ranges that have shot in there as well. But, yeah, the issue of ingestion of lead shot has come up recently about how that's evaluated. So that's definitely something that needs to be taken into account when you're doing site planning, what the range was historically used for.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I'm going to continue with the online questions. This next one is coming in from Orlando, Florida, and I believe this is in reference to one of your case studies. And they ask, how were the detected data interpreted? Any detection is considered an issue. What risk assessment guidance is used for site management decisions? And unfortunately, they didn't specify the case study, so I don't know if perhaps you can comment generally about detected data and its interpretation, and then what risk assessment guidance you used?
I'll go ahead and answer, Jean. I mean, I think the issue on risk assessment here, there are EPA risk screening levels for a number of these compounds that are in the current guidance, and it would be a comparison of what the data show in soil to those levels and then based on what either current or future land use may be. And then the detected data obviously can be used in the standard chemical risk methodology that EPA has already promulgated and been in place for a number of years. So there are cancer slope factors and non-cancer reference doses for a number of these compounds in the EPA IRIS database or Integrated Risk Information System database. So a lot of the standard risk assessment methodology procedures are already in place for these kind of compounds.
Okay, great. We're going to take our next question coming in from Lowell, Massachusetts, and they ask, what are the pros and cons to including vegetation in an increment sample?
Want to tackle that one, Marianne?
Oh, that's for me? All right. Well, the reason we include the vegetation, particularly at firing points, in an active firing point, is the propellant is falling on the surface, and if the surface is covered with vegetation, that's the collection media. Most of the explosives and propellants, as you can see, are on the surface, so that's when you want to analyze or include the vegetation in the sample. So, I don't know if you want to comment on the metallic residues, Jay.
It's a little bit different there in that the bullets are impacting. So they can penetrate a little bit into the soil. I mean, I think maybe Marianne, you want to comment on the analytical end of the vegetation or the processing. Is there an impact, on the processing procedures or impact on the analytical end when you include vegetation?
Okay, we actually have not had a problem with including the vegetation. Usually the vegetation is a very, very small, actually in mass terms, is actually very, very small, and when it's air-dried sufficiently and then ground with a ring and puck mill, we haven't actually had any problems with interferences analytically.
Okay. Our next question comes in from Lakewood, Colorado, and they ask, does milling overestimate the chemical concentration that would be bioavailable to humans or wildlife?
Okay, I'll comment on that. The milling has nothing to do with bioavailability. The methods that we're describing are to estimate the total mass of analyte in your sample. It's not a method for bioavailability.
Okay, great. Marianne, I think I have another question for you, and this is coming in from the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection, and they ask, are the grinding steps part of method 8330B, or is this something that we need to specify for the laboratory?
Well, it is part of Method 8330B, but you do need to specify it to the laboratory. You want to be very, very specific on how the sample is handled.
Okay, great. Thanks. Let's continue on. Our next question is coming from Augusta, Maine, and they ask, would one expect to find MC 50 years or more after a range closes in a temperate climate? Again, would one expect to find munitions constituents, or MC, 50 years or more after a range closes in a temperate climate?
Marianne, I'll take a shot at that one, Gene. One of the things here on this issue is the efficiency of the detonation is probably the single most relevant factor here. So whether it occurred 50 years ago or 5 years ago is probably the more relevant factor. There are some cases where in temperate climates you may get some transformation of TNT, and those analytes are on the on the 8330 list. We have sites, at least in the Pacific Northwest and Alaska, that range from arid climates to, you know, vegetation in Alaska that's, you know, tundra and things like that. But the chunk material will last a very, very long time, probably on the order of centuries. So it's really a function of how efficient the detonation or combustion was versus the length of time.
Okay, great. Let's carry on with our next question coming in from Boston, Massachusetts, and they ask, will the Army Corps be provided with this ISM training? And I'm not sure if they want Army Corps staff to be provided with this training, or if they're asking if the Army Corps is going to be providing this type of training to others.
As far as I know, there's no current plan for additional training.
Okay. Okay. And for the individual who asked this question, if you're referencing today's particular seminar, it will be recorded and it will be freely available for anyone to download and replay. So if you know of colleagues who you think would find it to be valuable, you'll be welcome to forward it or pass them on to the CLUIN website to download it and replay it.
Gene, that's fair. I think it's also we have a number of Army Corps representatives on the phone today too, so
we can also share that with their coworkers. Okay. All right, let's carry on. Our next question comes in from North Canton, Ohio, and this question goes out to you, Jay, in reference to slide 58. Could the higher average results for the milled lead samples on slide 58 be due to higher digestion efficiency of the smaller lead particles when compared to the unmilled samples?
That's a possibility, but I don't think it could contribute to the amount of increase that we've seen, because we see the same issue with energetics, you know, both explosives and the propellant compounds. So there probably is some increase due to digestion efficiency, but I don't know how much contribution there is there. I haven't really looked specifically at that particular issue. It may be a particular issue, and I've had discussions with risk assessors about this, whether or not milling is appropriate if you were then to use that soil material and do a bioavailability studies, because there you're changing the characteristics of the soil, and so the milled sample is not representative of, you know, what's out there in the field. So, but there's no consensus on that at this point in time.
Okay, thanks, Jay. We're coming up near our scheduled end time, but we do have a number of questions still in the queue. And since I do know a lot of people are still with us, I'm going to carry on a few minutes past our scheduled end time and try to get through as many of these questions that we have. So if everyone can bear with me for approximately 5 more minutes, we're going to keep going with the questions. So this next one is going to come in from EPA Region 6 out in Dallas, Texas. And they ask, are safety concerns high enough at any type of munition site to disallow ISM sampling?
Well, you always have an EOD escort, and it's that's the person that you're relying on to determine if it is safe or not to sample. Generally, they'll have a Shansat or some sort of magnetometer, and they'll look at the area at the specific location where you're going to use your sampling tool. So it's really up to the EOD escort.
Yeah, in some situations, you know, if you want to collect an increment at a particular spot, they may tell you to move over because, you know, their magnetometer is, you know, giving them some sort of reading.
I must say that when I first heard, I was first asked to go out onto the impact area, I was rather reluctant. But I've been doing this since 1990. I still have all my fingers and toes, and I thank the EOD escort folks for keeping us all safe, and we've never had a problem.
Great. Thanks, Marianne. Our next question comes in from the Army Corps out in Louisville, Kentucky, and they ask, what method is recommended or used to determine the specific number of samples, for example, 30, 50, 100?
So there you're referring to the number of increments. You know, the basic guidance is more than 30 increments, no less than 30 increments. And then, you know, the number that are collected is really a function of heterogeneity. So, you know, obviously you don't know what that is before you go out in the field and sample. So you got to kind of, you know, estimate, you know, in your head roughly, you know, what kind of degree of heterogeneity you expect. But there's no calculation that you can go through at the present time because there are just too many variables to account for. So, you know, our policy at Corral, you know, again, we're kind of more research orientated, but you know, typically we collect 50 or 100 increments. Doesn't take a whole lot of additional time to do that, and then usually our data is, you know, meets our precision criteria that we need, and then it really eliminates the need to go out and have to resample again.
Gene, I think what we've generally used as a rule of thumb is about 50 to 60 increments per acre as a starting point. I think if you look at all the historic studies that have been done here, that generally gets you within the range for, you know, precision goals as a starting point.
Okay, great. I have a related question, and this one's coming in also from the Army Corps, but this time out in Kansas City. And they ask, is there a relationship between the DU size and the number of increment samples? Is there a recommended DU max size?
Well, in terms of DU size, the largest that we've done is propellant studies at firing points. And I think, Marianne, we've gone up to about a hectare in size. So that's the largest. That's not saying you could go larger. But the DU size is not... has no impact, directly impact on the number of increments that you collect. The number of increments is a function of the degree of heterogeneity expected out in the field. So, you know, what's the spacing distance that you expect or between the particles that are out there in the field and how many particles, you know, you expect. Obviously, you won't know that. So that with that kept in mind, though, if you increase your DU size larger, then, and you have a set number of increments, say 50 increments, and your DU size is 1 acre, and then you go up to 2 acres in size, obviously the distance between your increments at the 2 acres is going to be greater than the distance between the increments at 1 acre. So, you know, as you go larger in DU size, there is a danger that you're, you know, decreasing the probability that any one increment you collect is going to have what you're interested in. So at some point, you know, you're going to reach a point where maybe majority of your increments are going to come back non-detect, and so then you've basically defeated your purpose. But there's no hard and fast rule to be able to calculate how many increments you need per size of a given DU.
Yeah, Gene, I think generally the upper limits have been about 100 by 100 meter or 1 hectare, or roughly 2 acres on decision unit size.
Okay, great. We have another question coming in from the Navy out in Norfolk, Virginia, and this is in reference to slide number 49. They made an observation that on slide number 49, and oh boy, it looks like I just lost something up. They were concerned that something looked out of line, or one of the curves seemed out of balance, and they wondered if you could look at the slide or the curve on 49 and provide comments. And I apologize, I just had a little technical glitch on my end. So I'll see if I can pull the exact text of the question up. If you guys could go back to slide 49 now and perhaps comment on the illustration in the meantime, that'd be helpful.
Yeah, I noticed that if you're referring to the little bars, They were supposed to be at the median, but they were lost, got lost in translation when the slides were made. So if you can just ignore the little bars. But each point represents a single sample. The black circles being the wheel, the red squares being the box, etc. So I hope that answers your question. Just ignore the bars. But you can see the median in the table.
Okay, great. We also had a question come in asking if you could generally comment on sampling on small arms firing ranges and if there would be a difference in your approach or methodology for small arms firing ranges. If you could discuss or comment on that.
I'm not sure what difference to what is being referred to. You know, the typical approach that's been used up until this point in time is the, you know, traditional grab or discrete sample. And having come from the environmental industry and talking with colleagues, you know, a typical approach might be to collect, I don't know, a half dozen to a dozen discrete or grab samples and then try to interpolate the data, you know, over that area of interest. And, you know, the thing that's different with the ISM or the multi-increment sampling procedure in the field is you define a decision unit and you're blanketing that area with an increased number of increments over that given area. So that's, I'm not sure exactly what they're talking about in terms of difference, but I mean, clearly ISM is different than the way we've been doing things in the past.
Okay, we also had another question that came in asking if you could comment on how this document and what you presented today correlates to the RAGS guidance from EPA, which I believe is their risk assessment guidance?
I guess I'll take a stab at that one. I mean, the issue here is that the collected analytical data, the concentrations, and the replicate samples would be used in the same methodology as other samples have been used in the past. One of the differences here is the precision on this usually is much better, and one of the goals is to have normal distributions on the replicate sample so that you can use more simple statistical methods based on normal distributions versus non-normal distributions in the past where you had to do a lot of different types of statistical tests on it. So that's one of the goals here too, is to have better precision, better replication, and have normalized distributions that would make it simpler to do risk assessment.
Okay, great. Thank you. We're going to just take one more question, and I'm going to take two of them that are related and sort of merge them together. So one part of the question is coming from King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. The other is coming from Greenville, South Carolina. And they're both asking about incremental sampling. So the first one asks that they understand the benefit of IS for propellant evaluation based on the method by which the contaminant is dispersed. But are you now recommending IS for metals as well, even though their presence in the soil is via a more discrete deposition method, for example, related to the accumulation of bullets and metal fragments?
I'll take that. And, yes, we are recommending ISM in situations where you have metallic residues, so that's solid material being deposited on the soil surface. On small arms ranges, we're seeing high degree of heterogeneity. So, in situations where, you have some expectation that your analyte of interest is going to be close to whatever action level you're dealing with, if it's critical, to not be above that action level, then we would recommend the ISM procedures because, whether you fall above or below that action line, your outcome is significantly different and costs are going to be significantly different. So, when you need higher precision, definitely do ISM. And I recommend, even in situations where you don't need to have that precision, probably it's best to use ISM because what we found is if you use the traditional, conventional, or discrete or grab sampling approach, your sample results really not representative of the area, and you certainly can't go back and reproduce it with duplicate samples because I think we've all been there where we've collected duplicate samples and the duplicates are, totally different. And so, you know, typical approach is then, well, let's just throw out the high concentration and use a low one, or, oh, you know, if you get the risk assessor involved, maybe let's take the average concentration of the two and use that. Well, I don't think either approach is really right.
Okay, great. And that second part to the related question, a few individuals have asked if you're starting to see other federal or state agencies moving towards using IS, or if other states are picking it and implementing it as a policy at these types of sites.
I'm involved with the ITRC group, which is, you know, made up of a number of state agencies. I can tell you that many states are jumping on the ISM bandwagon. They're very gung-ho about it, maybe too gung-ho in my opinion. You know, they're advocating ISM not only for the, you know, energetics and the metals, but even for SVOCs, PCBs, etc. So I'm a little more cautious in that I'd like to see research data before, you know, we move to SVOCs or EOCs or what have you. But I think at least for the energetics and now for the metals, you know, metals were almost there in terms of having sufficient information to provide recommendations. In terms of energetics, you know, we're already there. Other constituents, I think we need to collect some additional data before we start moving in that direction. But it's definitely coming. I mean, the states are, in my opinion, ahead of the EPA and you know, DOD or DOE. I mean, they're driving the bus now.
Dean, I would also comment some states like Alaska and Hawaii, and I believe Ohio already has some guidance, state guidance out there on use of incremental sampling or multi-increment sampling.
Okay, great. Thank you. Actually, you mentioned the ITRC ISM group, and someone commented that they're actually going to be hosting training. And again, that's the ITRC ISM group will be doing training November 6th and November 13th. And if you visit the ITRC website or even on CLUIN, you'll be able to find more details about that training. Well, we are definitely past our scheduled end time of 3 p.m., so I'm going to go ahead and close this period for Q&A with our presenters. I will say that if you have additional questions or comments, you're welcome to follow up with either myself or the presenters afterwards and try to, again, either email us or give me a phone call, and we'll try to connect you with the presenter to get your questions answered. We're on slide number 73, and we're going to go through and start the closeout procedures. But before I do that, I just want to check to make sure that our other co-moderator, Rich, and our other speakers today, do you have any final statements or thoughts you'd like to share?
I would just like to once again thank everybody that participated and thank everybody that also had questions, and I would also thank our presenters that spent a lot of time and effort to present this webinar today. And also thank you for giving us all your technical advice.
Great. Thank you. Well, with that, I'm going to go ahead and direct everyone on to slide number 74, which is our resources and feedback slide. As we mentioned a little bit earlier in today's session, there's a resources page. If you click on that link on slide 74, you can download a copy of today's presentation material, but we'll also include a number of other resources and guidance documents that were referenced from today's presentation. The other link that you'll see on slide number 74 is a link to our short feedback form. I would ask you to take just a minute to fill this out. I do read each and every one of the responses that go in there. And if you like to see future sessions delivered this way and continue to enjoy free technical training offered through CLUIN, please fill out that form. It's your feedback that helps us to continue to improve our deliveries and make sure we offer training like this. If you shared the line with multiple individuals, each person can fill out their own feedback form. And what's real critical, also, I get a lot of questions about this, we don't offer CEUs or PDHs for training certificates, per se, but if you fill out the feedback form, there's a box you can check. It's circled in red. As long as your email has been filled in correctly, a confirmation message will be sent to you after you fill out the feedback form, at least verifying that you did fill out feedback after the live event was delivered. If you keep that feedback form email as well as a copy of the slides and your registration email, that may be enough to get credit from your accrediting organization, so that'll be up to you to pursue. I'll move everybody along to slide number 75, and that's just a short advertisement to let you know that we are continually trying to reach out to our audience here on Kluin and to help stay connected and share the latest information for cleaning up hazardous waste sites. So not only can you find us at kluin.org, but if you're on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach out and connect with us there. I also want to echo my thanks to both the EPA's Federal Facilities Forum as well as the Army Corps of Engineers for putting together today's training, as well as the over 395 live online participants that joined today's session from all over the country. I hope that you found today to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that we'll either see you or hear from you on a future Kluin seminar. Please remember today's session was recorded and you will automatically receive an email as soon as the recording is available for free replay, and you'll be able to forward it on and share the information with anyone that you think will find this to be useful. So again, thank you all very much for joining us today, for staying a little bit past our end time, and I hope you all have a great rest of your day. This is the formal conclusion for today's Kluin seminar.